You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jake Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a historian tells us why we can learn lessons from 1968, 50 years later.
First, the White House has officially released its long-anticipated plan to address the nation's aging infrastructure. Among other things, President Trump's plan would aim to generate at least $1.5 trillion in new investment, with only some of that money coming from the federal government.
The plan also comes amid the backdrop of a new federal budget proposal that would lead to increased deficits, and lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have expressed doubts about the infrastructure plan as it's written.
Heather Long is an economics correspondent for the Washington Post. Heather, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back.
So this plan has been about a year in the making. It's something that the president campaigned on, and we've been getting little bits of information here and there about what might be in it. Now that the full document is out there in front of us, what are we looking at? Any major surprises?
No major surprises, but I think a lot of disappointment in Washington and around the country. You talked about the headline number of hoping, White House is hoping for $1.5 trillion. The reality is they're only proposing $200 billion of additional funds, so much more of a drop in the bucket compared to what they're trying to claim this plan could do. And if you look, the question, of course, is where are they even getting that $200 billion? And what they're doing is they're supposedly saying, oh, we're going to take it from other parts of the budget. So we're going to cut other transportation programs and some other safety net programs, and we're going to take that money, and then we're going to go and build more roads and bridges. So it's sort of like taking from one hand and giving to the other hand. So that's why on both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans are sort of shaking their heads like, yes, we need to do something on infrastructure, but this is not the plan.
And you were saying federally, it's going to be $200 billion. That's going to come from some safety net programs, some already existing transit programs. So let's kind of parse that. Let's look into it. What infrastructure spending is already going to get hit with this infrastructure plan?
Yeah, that's a good question. Let me pull up the list. We were looking at this earlier. So it's again a hodgepodge. There's about 10 different things that are currently in the budget that they're planning to cut a little bit. So for instance, like the Army Corps of Engineers funding or grants to Amtrak, they would take a little bit of money from there. But the biggest one, which is kind of frustrating to a lot of lawmakers, is that they're saying that they would take some of the highway trust fund money, and which is currently one of the major sources of funding for road construction in the country, and they're saying they would take some of that and reallocate it. So again, it's like, why are we reallocating money that's already going to road construction?
So you kind of asked a question within a question there, but is there any rationale as to why that was the decision in this plan?
I think if the White House were on the phone here, that they would argue, as they have to some reporters, that they feel that the money could be spent more efficiently. And in particular, the big impetus behind this plan from the president is to delegate more of the decisions about where the funding goes and where what types of programs get funded to the state. So the state of Wisconsin would basically get some sort of block grant, and they would be able to then decide where the money would go, as opposed to at the moment the White House feels that there's too much kind of top-down, too much of Washington telling parts of the country which projects are go ahead and which should not.
We're talking to Heather Long right now. She is an economics correspondent for The Washington Post, talking about this $1.5 trillion plan, infrastructure plan, that the White House unveiled today. So going from $200 billion to $1.5 trillion, how are we going to get the rest of this money?
Well, I'm from Pennsylvania, and I know you all are sitting there in Wisconsin, and the idea is that our home states would put up the rest of the funding. So it would be a combination of state dollars, of local dollars, and of private money. Now, whenever you say private money, it sounds great. We would get pension funds and others to put up the initial seed capital, but of course they want payment back, and that usually is a code buzzword, right? We hear private funding for toll roads. And again, you can toll some of the roads across the country. Countries like Australia have done that very effectively. But I don't know about Wisconsin. I've been there twice, and I can imagine, just like Pennsylvania, you can't put a toll on every single road in that state.
That is a big conversation here in the state right now, with open road tolling being something being talked about. So, Heather, you know, the president has been talking a long time about, you know, the roads are bad. Rural areas need broadband, that there's all of this infrastructure that needs to be fixed. What are some of the biggest needs out there that I guess the president would like to see taken care of?
So that's one of the biggest frustrations with this plan, is there's clearly a huge number of needs. We can all point to things in our own communities that need to be upgraded. But what this plan really does is it says that the federal government is going to help fund whatever could get matching funds. So whatever projects, you know, there would be private dollars that would be willing to fund, or that there would be state money that would be willing to fund. And that's not necessarily where the most critical needs are, nor is it, I have come from an economics background, what you'd like to see is the most bang for your buck. So you'd like to see projects that are going to generate the most jobs and the most return for our country. And that's where the frustration, it feels like this plan is a real disconnect between what's needed and what could really benefit the U.S. versus the types of projects that would be preferred under the strategy the Trump administration has outlined.
Now, you said that some of this is federal money, some of it is state money, and some of it will be private, public-private partnerships. Some people might be a little wary of that. Have there been any states that have been able to utilize public-private partnerships in terms of infrastructure well?
That's a loaded question. In the United States, there's certainly been a lot of hesitancy. And there in the Midwest, a lot of people point to Indiana as a real example of how things can go very badly. But again, other countries have done it successfully. A lot of people, of course, holding up Australia and even some projects in Canada that they feel have gone well on public-private partnership. So it can be done. I think it's important to point out that President Trump's top infrastructure advisor is named D.J. Gibbon, and D.J. Gibbon used to be a high-level person at Macquarie Bank, which is one of the big Australian banks that has done a lot of public-private partnerships. So that's another reason, perhaps, that there's quite a bit of that in this plan. So some people have raised some skepticism about that.
Do we know what parts of this plan, obviously it's day one that we have it, but what parts of this plan could potentially become a reality?
Yeah, I think the big takeaway here is the administration wants to do something. While they are getting a lot of criticism for this plan, there is general agreement. Something needs to be done. There's general agreement that permitting takes too long, which is, you know, President Trump likes to talk about, it takes 10 years now. We need to get it under two. Is the real number 10 years? No, it's not. But anything that they could reduce the amount of time, there's general agreement that needs to be done. There's general agreement on what you were talking about earlier, that we're going to need money specifically dedicated for rural infrastructure, because that clearly can't be told. And there's also general agreement that starting in the late 1990s, the United States federal government dedicated funds, basically federally backed loans. So instead of giving just pure grant dollars, they would do these loans, federally backed loans. And that program has worked extremely well. As a matter of fact, it's been expanded from not just funding highways that way, but now we fund ports and some railroad projects that way. And part of this proposal from the Trump administration is, hey, that program has been working well. Let's expand it even more to more, say, water projects or hydro projects or, you know, other types of infrastructure projects. So those types of initiatives get a lot of bipartisan support. They make a lot of sense. But I think what you're going to see going forward is Congress is really going to have to pick up the ball here and actually craft the details of this plan. The good thing is the White House isn't saying no to anything. For instance, most people think if this is really going to happen, big scale, like what we need, we may need something like a gas tax increase. I know I don't like the sound of that either, but we haven't raised that gas tax since 1993. If we really want to make massive investments in our country, we got to pay for them. That's one way to do it.
Well, Heather, you actually ended up answering my final question about the gas tax. So I guess we will leave it there for now. A lot to get to in the future. So, Heather, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
Heather Long is an economics correspondent for The Washington Post. She joined us to talk about the White House's newly released plan to address the nation's aging infrastructure.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. That's All Along the Watchtower by Jimi Hendrix, released 50 years ago in 1968. In that year, there were protests and riots across the country against racism, sexism, and the Vietnam War. Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy were assassinated, and Richard Nixon was elected president. And our next guest says that the year 1968 has lessons for us in the year 2018.
Jeremy Suri is with us now. He's the Mac Brown Distinguished Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He's written and edited books on 1968. His latest book is The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. Jeremy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, Jeremy, I think a lot of people get the sense that 1968 was a pivotal year in American history. You've written about it more generally. It was a big year globally, wasn't it?
Yes, it was one of those years. We have these years every now and then where you had simultaneous disruption, simultaneous challenges to existing orders and existing assumptions of politics and personal behavior across four continents, really, in the United States, in Europe, in Asia, and in South America, as well as almost every other part of the globe as well.
It's been 50 years. Some people see parallels, a tumultuous time, questioning a lot of assumptions in 2018. Do you see those parallels?
I do. I think there are three striking parallels. Of course, there are many differences, but the three parallels that appear very strong to me are, first, the existing political parties, the existing political institutions, don't seem credible or satisfying anymore for a majority of people, or at least a vocal number of people in many societies. This is true with the Brexit vote. This is true with the 2016 election in the United States. Second, this uncertainty, this discontent has produced an opening for change. It's very disheartening at moments. It's very scary. I know I'm scared. But the scariness of our moment means there's also an openness for transformation, as there certainly was in 1968. And then the third point is there are a lot of people being hurt by this disruption. This is something that often gets lost in the rock and roll histories of 1968, not just the assassinations of American political figures, but the thousands of Americans who died in Vietnam and the violence that occurred in places like Prague, Paris, and other parts of the world. These moments of transition are very violent and very hurtful for many people, and that's something we are not paying enough attention to right now.
Is 1968 and the present day, are they notably different than other times? Because we could name off lots of times that were the standard order of things was being disrupted, the Depression era, the World Wars, things like that. Are they all turbulent times, or was there something distinctive about 1968?
I think there is always turbulence in the world, Rob, and maybe there's more turbulence than ever with the faster movement of media and communications as a whole. But there are these moments about every half century or so when things seem to happen in different places at the same time where they normally don't happen. And I think in part that's because of the linkages of parts of the world, but that's also because of what we as historians would point to as structural problems that reach fruition. Another way of putting this is that intolerable situations, dissatisfying situations can go on for a long time, but they reach a breaking point, and they tend to reach a breaking point at similar moments in similar societies. And that's certainly what we experienced in 68, and I think it's what we're experiencing again today.
So in 1968, those structural problems, I mean, you had the end of the colonial era and the last sort of dying signs of that with the war in Vietnam and problems elsewhere, and also here in the United States in particular, issues of race. Do you see those as a couple of the big issues that came to a head in 1968?
Absolutely. The way I would put that to bring up the parallels for today is we saw the changing nature of the international system where a few dominant powers were not able to control far reaches of their former empires in the way they normally could before. And we saw the emergence and the recognition of racism and struggles over the future of what a post-racial society would look like, or at least a less racist society would look like, not just in the United States, but in places like France that also had racial issues at that time. And I think a lot of those are parallels with today. At the root of these shifts, I think, are two other things, Rob. One is demographic change. The late 60s saw the coming of age of a new large generation of post-World War II citizens who had gone to university, were more educated than their parents, and had a different perspective on the world. And the second big change is that the economies that had produced so much wealth, at least in Western Europe and the United States, were beginning to run into trouble in the late 60s because of the emerging oil crisis, inflation, and various other issues. And the economic and demographic pressures then, as today, pushed rapid political change.
Jeremy Suri is with us, historian from the University of Texas, Austin, comparing and contrasting 1968, a big year, a turbulent year in American history and world history, and lessons we can learn here in 2018. Jeremy, you mentioned that new generation, the baby boomers in the 1960s, when people, people had a stereotypical view of the 1960s, it would involve a lot of, I think, youth activism. Are you seeing comparable things today?
I think so. First of all, just anecdotally, Rob, my students have never been more engaged than they are today. This makes the Obama moment of 2008 look far less engaging than it is today. Our young people are more worried, but they're also more engaged in politics, more active. Look at all the women marches around the country. And then social media, through the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter, and various other forums, is providing for more communication and activism among young people than we've seen in a long time. So I think this is the millennial political moment. What it will produce, I'm still not certain, but I do think there's a lot of evidence of renewed, expanded engagement among young people.
And there are two different reads on that then and now, in the 1960s and now. A lot of youth activism. Some people might say that's great. It's encouraging. People are looking to change the world for the better. There might also be a reaction that the world is out of control. These young people are out of control. We need to rein things in. So you could end up with Richard Nixon becoming elected president by expressing that view, later Ronald Reagan following in his footsteps, and now Donald Trump today. It's a double-edged coin.
As with all coins, there are two sides, there's no doubt. And the inclination, and this gets us into the space about historical lessons, the inclination in the late 60s among some was indeed to try to batten down the hatches and reestablish order. And that was the allure of Richard Nixon's law and order and silent majority claims. And to some extent, that's the allure of Donald Trump for many people. But the lesson from the late 60s, Rob, is that you cannot bottle up these changes. And in fact, changes continued and transformed American society. If you think about gay rights, if you think about feminism, if you think about the startup economies in Silicon Valley and Austin, Texas, our world was transformed by these broader tectonic shifts. And they were largely positive, though not entirely.
I'm going to jump in, Jeremy, where your line's breaking up a little. We're going to try reconnecting real quickly. Just as a reminder, we're talking to historian Jeremy Suri, learning lessons from 1968, a turbulent year, a pivotal year in American and world history in many ways. And today he's looking at some comparisons and contrasts between the two. Coming up in just a bit, we'll talk to a guest who says, yeah, a lot of the economic growth in the United States is concentrated in the biggest cities, a handful of metropolitan areas. He says, don't give up on the rest of the country, on the smaller cities, on rural America, just because that's not where the action is this year. That's coming up in just a little bit after the news. Reconnecting with Jeremy Suri now for our conversation about 1968. Hopefully have him on the line in just a moment. Things don't look all that promising. We'll see. You can call in with your thoughts. You can get ready to be on the air for our next conversation. If you are in a smaller city, a smaller community around Wisconsin, you can get your call in now and get on the line. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. You can always email about any of the topics we're talking about at ideas@WPR.org. Still no luck on reconnecting with Jeremy Suri after that rough phone line. So let's start inviting your calls in now. Henry Grabar will be with us from Slate talking about smaller communities in America and the American economy. Get your calls in now, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org.
And of course, you can again call 800-642-1234. With this conversation with Henry Grabar coming up, do you live in a small to medium-sized city? Do you have you seen some bad news in terms of jobs, factory closings, and other problems? We want to get you on the line for this conversation.
Looks like we have Jeremy Suri back on the line. Jeremy, sorry about that. We had a bad line. I just want to get to some takeaways as we wrap up. As American people are watching turbulent times, what are you watching for in the years to come?
I'm watching for two things, Rob. First, whether the political system finds leaders who will speak to the broader youth engagement and speak to the broader issues, some of the things that Bernie Sanders began to speak to. And second, whether new institutions are formed as well as new leaders, whether we see the equivalent of some of the student movement organizations turning into mainstream organizations in the way they did in the 1970s.
And is Democrat and Republican going to mean something different in a couple years than it did 2 years ago?
Absolutely. The parties will be redefined in their meaning. Whether these two parties survive, I don't know. I think right now we already have the splintering of the Republican Party into two separate parties. And I think the meaning of these parties, think how different the meaning of race was for the Democratic Party after the 1960s versus where it was in the 1950s. Certainly one party is going to have to speak to women of color much more. One party is going to have to speak to white voters who don't see themselves identifying with the Tea Party and identifying with Donald Trump. So we are going to see major shifts in these parties as we did after 1968.
Jeremy, thanks for bearing with us on the phone line. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Rob.
That's Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas, Austin, with us to talk about what 1968 can teach us today, 50 years later. Now, there's been a long-running gradual economic recovery in the United States since the Great Recession. Overall, job growth has been steady for years.
But that growth isn't concentrated evenly around the United States. The bulk of job growth is in 20 or so metropolitan areas, while smaller cities and rural areas are holding steady at best, or even seeing declining job numbers. And it's a similar story within states. In Wisconsin, for example, Dane County is seeing substantial job growth. A few other counties are doing well, and many others are being left behind.
Our guest says policymakers should pay attention and not give up on smaller cities and rural areas. Henry Grabar is a staff writer for Slate. He wrote about this topic there. Henry, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we laid out a little bit of the basics there, but can you hash out a little more of that divergence? Who is seeing growth, who isn't in the United States?
Yeah, well, the map that Mark Morrow, who's the economist from Brookings, whose work I was talking about here, a number of other economists have done similar research, and the map of places that are doing well corresponds pretty neatly to the places that voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016. So it's the major metropolitan areas. I mean, she won basically every metro area in the country. And pretty much everywhere else voted for Donald Trump. So that's the kind of geography we're looking at. And obviously, there's some discrepancy within those big cities about, you know, which cities are thriving and which are not. But I think that the 2016 election was viewed as a kind of a wake-up call for people to say there's a lot of areas of this country where the recovery has not happened, where people don't feel they've participated in the prosperity of the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, Obama's second term. And Trump obviously played to that. You know, he talked a lot about people who have been left behind, about American carnage, about resuscitating these areas. And so I was surprised to see that he made these comments in upstate New York where he said, you know, if things aren't working out for you, I'm going to tell people you can move. You don't have to keep living here. And that, to me, echoed what I've been hearing from economists for years, which is, the real problem in America is not that some areas are not working, it's that people aren't moving. It's that Americans move less than they ever have. I mean, we're a famously restless and mobile country, and that's kind of died out, and that's one of the issues here, is that you don't have people moving to cities like San Francisco or New York or Los Angeles at the rates that they once did. So that's been the dominant theory of these economists, and I was trying to challenge this by saying, you know, even if there were enough places to live, if housing was cheap enough for this to really happen, it's just not that realistic to expect that, you know, the entire middle of the country is just going to pack up and move to 12 coastal cities where wages are really much higher.
You had that quote from President Trump, and you also cited people really across the spectrum, liberal to conservative, going with that you can leave concept. So what do we lose if we give up on those cities that aren't doing well, you know, right now in the 20-teens?
Well, I think, you know, there's a few levels, right? On the one hand, it's an immediate kind of it's a problem in American politics that we essentially are living with two separate countries. If you look at some of the data about housing, or you look at some of the data about wages, you look at some of the data about life expectancy, you find that the variance between some of these big cities I'm talking about, what Richard Florida calls the superstar cities, and some of the rural areas of the country are really enormous. And that makes it hard to even get together around a table and say, okay, what do we need to do? This was a realization that I had when I was at this the Hometown Conference in Charlottesville, Virginia, last year, which is a conference dedicated to small cities. And we were sitting around this table and we realized that even though everyone there was representing a small city, we were all dealing with extremely different issues, and in fact, in some cases, opposite issues, where some people were saying housing's too expensive, and other people were saying, well, in my city, actually, housing's too cheap, and nobody will invest, nobody will fix up these houses. And so, you know, there's that political problem, and then there's the humanitarian issue when you have a place like Flint, Michigan, where you've got, you know, a humanitarian crisis on your hands. And then finally, there's maybe a quality of life argument for preserving places of this size. I think they offer sort of political avenues for everyday people that aren't available if you live in a metropolis of, you know, 10 million people. And then finally, I guess there's the sort of unforeseen hazards argument, which is that we don't know what the next 10 or 20 years is going to bring. Nobody would have thought that New York would be on top of the world 40 years ago. And so if you let these other places deteriorate to the point where it becomes difficult to repair the housing stock and the museum closes down and the pipes don't work anymore, then you've essentially crossed that place off the list. I mean, to some extent, I think it's our responsibility to keep them in repair just from a practical standpoint, even if it wasn't a humanitarian issue.
Henry Gerbara is with us, staff writer for Slate. He says policymakers don't give up on rural America, on smaller cities, even though right now a lot of the job growth, a lot of the economic and population growth, for that matter, is in a handful of currently successful metropolitan areas. In the piece we're talking about, Henry, you write about these concerns, similar concerns coming up in, I think it was 1906 under President Teddy Roosevelt. Can you talk about what they saw then and what they tried to do?
Yeah, well, the question is as old as the country itself. I mean, the rate of urbanization in the United States has never stopped going up. Some point in the early 20th century, right as the cities were creating the Gilded Age and the unfathomable sums of wealth and great mansions, not just in New York City, but in places like Cleveland and Chicago and Cincinnati, fortunes being made. Teddy Roosevelt started this thing called the Commission on Country Life, which was dedicated basically to what we would now call brain drain, and saying, what are some investments we could make? What are some technologies we could look at? What are some social programs that might help rural America become a more attractive place to live? In the end, it didn't work out, although one of the reasons it didn't work out was purely political. Congress was mad at Roosevelt. That kind of suppressed the findings of the commission. But I do think that such an endeavor might be interesting now, not only because they might come up with ideas for how to make smaller places competitive, like investing in broadband or something like that, or skills training program, or, you know, investing more in these big research universities that sometimes anchor small towns, but also because it would lend some authority to the problem. I think having a commission of experts in Washington who had sort of a bunch of prestige to address this issue and remind people that It's something that policymakers take seriously, which is not something that I feel like we have the impression of hearing hearing somebody like, you know, the president say, well, you can just move. I think that would be helpful.
A lot of cities, big and small, are wrestling with these issues at the local level, trying to come up with solutions at the local level. Can these be solved without something at the federal level?
I don't know. I do think that it's the record of local economic development incentives is not good. So when you have cities saying, oh, well, we will give X plot of land tax-free to company Y for 30 years so that they can create a few jobs, that has historically not worked out well. So the record of those moonshots is not very good. I think cities do better when they focus on fundamentals. You know, obviously, if your city becomes a place where people don't want to live anymore, then you're really in trouble. And I think the cities that, you know, to some extent, the best thing they can do is the simplest thing, which is to continue to offer good services, clean up the trash, make sure the sidewalks are in good shape, continue to fund arts organizations and farmers markets and other things that make it attractive to live there. You know, I mean, I think that to some extent that was Richard Florida's theory about the creative class. I think that it was, you know, it didn't really work out because I think some of these incentives were not well placed. No doubt some sort of federal assistance is going to be necessary. I think that's inevitable. But, you know, I do think that there are decisions that cities can make that can help for sure.
Henry Grabara is with us. We're talking about his piece on America's smaller cities and rural areas. A lot of job growth and population growth is concentrated in a handful of places, mostly big metropolitan areas around the country. But he says we shouldn't give up as individuals, as a government, on smaller communities.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you live in a small to medium-sized city? Have you seen bad news in terms of jobs, factory closings, and other problems? Are there bright spots, signs of growth in your community, and what does your community need to thrive? Are you thinking of moving from Wisconsin to another state or within the state to find a job? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Henry Grabara is with us. He says we need to do more to revitalize America's smaller cities as job and population growth is more and more concentrated in some of the biggest cities.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 if you live in a smaller town, a smaller city, even a mid-sized city in Wisconsin. What is happening where you are? Are you seeing people leaving, jobs leaving? Are you seeing bright spots, good signs where you are? What do you need where you live? And have you considered moving, or have you moved to get a job either within Wisconsin or are you planning to move out of the state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. TJ is on the line in Clinton. TJ, hi.
Hi, how are we doing today?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
So just a quick comment before I get to what I called about. Anybody who's in the southern Wisconsin region, I don't know if you've noticed, but you see postings for job openings all over this area. And I know the company I work for, we're having a hard time filling positions. So on our side, it's actually looking pretty good, especially over the last year and a half. The reason I'm calling in, though, about what your guest was touching base on about what small communities can do, I was curious if he knows of any municipalities or local governments that are starting to look more at financial and economics education within the local school systems, being middle school and high school.
TJ, thanks for the call. His first point first, actually, Henry, this is not universal bad news horror story in every smaller American community, right?
Yeah, that's good to hear. I think, actually, I got a lot of feedback when I wrote this piece, and one of the things people said was that I was conflating small cities with regions that aren't functioning well. And it's true that there are some big cities that aren't doing so hot, and then there are small cities and rural areas that are doing quite well. Like if you look at some of the places, you know, some of these small cities outside of Boston, for example, or university towns. So I do think that's true that there's quite a lot of diversity in there. I think the larger point that I was trying to get at was that it's not an accident of history that big cities are thriving and pulling in more people and creating more jobs. I mean, we've made decisions at the federal level about how we treat, say, corporate consolidation, how we treat, education funding and other things that have helped to create an environment where these big cities do really well. I think that remains true, even though there are bright spots in certain places, and that's great to hear. With respect to the second question, I do think there's a lot of room here for innovation in education. I think the problem is it's hard to know what to do, and people are wary of undertaking experiments. Nobody really wants to be a guinea pig when it comes to how they're going to educate their kids. I think that teaching financial literacy in high school is a great idea. But when it comes to, you know, big experiments, I think that people are wary of that.
TJ, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Robin on the line in Cumberland. Robin, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Robin?
Well, you were talking about people moving different places for jobs and so on. And I just wanted to say that here where I live in Cumberland in Barron County, we have all kinds of jobs up here. I personally know of at least three businesses in our small town and the surrounding area that have gone out of business because they were unable to find enough workers.
Robin, thanks for that call. And Henry, is that part of the story as people often move out of these smaller areas? It's holding back business in some cases because they can't get people to move back in and take those jobs.
Well, one of the theories that that economists have is that there's a skills gap, and I guess this gets back a little bit to what TJ was saying, which is that it's not that there are too many workers and not enough jobs. It's just that we don't have workers who are trained to do the jobs that are available. And I'm not exactly sure if that's the type of thing that the caller is talking about, but that's certainly a widespread phenomenon. I think it's an argument for more investment in education and workforce training, which is actually probably one of the economic development programs, one of the best records. And then the other thing I'd say is that it's an argument for more immigration, and that's something that has been talked about as a revitalizing force in cities. I mean, if you look at any big city in this country, from New York to Los Angeles to Chicago, Philadelphia, if you subtract the immigrants that are living there, those cities aren't growing. They're shrinking. And that has been one of the keys to the last 30 years of prosperity in those places. I think that when you restrict the ability of people to come here, you sometimes cut off places that could use the skills that they bring.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Henry Grabar with Slate, looking at jobs and population growth in big metropolitan areas, a handful of them around the country seeing big growth, a lot of other areas holding steady or falling behind. Back to your calls now with Sai and Madison. Sai, hi.
Hi. I have a one comment. 2 years ago, me and my wife, we moved from New York to Madison, Wisconsin. And my wife, she had a... Back in New York, she was a director in the design industry. And in Madison, she's unemployed for the last 1 year. She got laid off. And it's really hard for her to find a higher paycheck job in Madison. So I know the small jobs are coming more, but higher paycheck jobs are not so much available in southern Wisconsin.
Sai, thanks for the call. And Henry, that's an interesting perspective, New York to Madison. If you look at that map you mentioned from Brookings earlier, Madison and its county, Dane County, are one of the high spots for job growth and job creation in Wisconsin. But from this perspective, coming from New York, not great jobs available, at least for Sai's wife.
Well, this is why economists say it's time for everybody to move to one of these big cities, because there is, you know, these are places where when you're looking at a fairly tight market and people are looking, both workers looking for jobs and employers looking for employees, it's just easier to find people when there's 21 million people living there. So you know, the question of how you create those white-collar professional jobs outside of a handful of cities is a really difficult question. I would be curious to hear, you know, what kind of opportunity she has found in Madison, and maybe talk to some of those firms and say, you know, what kind of work are you doing? What kind of policies would help you expand? How could we attract, create an environment where more design jobs could thrive in Madison? What if there was a partnership with the university, you know, so on.
Saeed, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Mike in Lake Tomahawk. Mike, hi.
Hi, Rob. My point is that part of the skills gap problem, not all of it, but a large portion of it, is that employers are no longer willing to train their employees while employing them. You know, this is part of the decline in unions and things like that. It used to be you go to an employer, they would hire you, and they would train you to do their specific task. Employers are less willing to do that nowadays, and then they complain that they can't find help.
Mike, thanks for the call. Henry, do you see that as at least part of the puzzle here?
Oh, absolutely. That's certainly been my experience in the jobs that I've had. Start on your feet. Take you know, I hope your education's good enough, and they, you know, throw you in the deep end. And that's, well, I guess, you know, there's probably any number of things that are behind that, but it's certainly true. And it's, again, it's one of those things that I think could be addressed at the federal level if we wanted to do so. I mean, we just passed this gigantic tax bill that provides basically huge tax cuts to corporate income without tying any of that to some of these carrots that could have helped help workers. You know, like, if it's not inconceivable that we could have said, well, here's your tax break if you have shown evidence that you are providing some sort of training program to help workers fit into these jobs. And that's, you do see that in local economic development deals where they say, okay, well, you know, Company X is going to provide a jobs training program, and that's why we're going to give them this fine plot of city-owned land right downtown. But that shouldn't be the responsibility, I think, of the localities to bargain here and there with every company. I mean, I would love to see that implemented at a national scale, to have that be the expectation when you get a job, that that's something that corporations offer. But I think one of the maybe pitfalls of shareholder-driven capitalism is that there is no financial incentive to set up an in-house training shop to get better workers, at least in the very short term.
We'll leave it there for now. Henry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Henry Grabar. He's a staff writer for Slate. He's been making the case that we need to do more to revitalize smaller cities and rural America as job growth is concentrated in a handful of major metro areas. We've got a link to the piece he wrote. You can go to WPR.org and go to Central Time under the shows list. You can find that link while you're there.